And as the war goes on in Afghanistan, life goes on here in the United States, where Woody Allen has been making movies for 40 years. Critic Kenneth Turan says you have to care about Allen's long career in order to care about his new film, Whatever Works.
Woody Allen is back in his Manhattan home base for the first time in 5 films. His latest effort is a quasi-romantic comedy about the relationship between misanthropic genius Larry David and a dim-witted southern beauty queen turned young runaway, played by Evan Rachel Wood.
Well, my daddy says that America bends over backwards for the blacks because we feel guilty and it's crazy.
Oh, yeah, your daddy's a cracker. He's a bigot moron, your daddy.
Well, you're probably right because you're a genius, but, you know, for a little Mississippi girl like me, this is really exciting. So what kind of genius are you anyway?
What kind? Quantum mechanics.
Yeah, but what field? Like music?
This script was apparently written by Allen more than 30 years ago with the great Zero Mostel in mind to star as terminally bitter Boris Yelnikov. That's Yelnikov with an emphasis on yell. It's not Mostel you will be imagining in this role, but the writer-director himself. Woody Allen's quiet presence would make the script's torrent of dyspeptic lines more palatable. Yelnikov's recitation of abuse quickly becomes more repetitive and tiresome than funny. How many times, after all, can you get a laugh by calling people imbeciles?
Don't send that cretin to me anymore. I can't teach an empty-headed zombie chess.
There's too much hard-edged savagery in Larry David's line readings, much more so than in his TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm, and it throws things out of balance.
I picked up the board and dumped the pieces on his head. As an object lesson to shake him out of his vegetable torpor.
Whatever works just doesn't work. There was a time in films like Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters when Allen's characters were both funny and recognizable human beings. The work necessary to accomplish that is something the writer-director can't be bothered with anymore. Political scientists study Stalinism without Stalin, so maybe it's time for cinema PhDs to consider dissertations on Allenism without Allen.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the LA Times, and we review Sandra Bullock's new romantic comedy, The Proposal, and others at NPR.org.
The Model as Muse show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has been a crowd pleaser since it opened in May. Why not? It's a chronological tour of 50 years of stunning gowns and classic photographs of many, many gorgeous models. As we toured the show with Harold Coda, the curator in charge at the Met's Costume Institute, and guest curator, cultural historian Cole Yohannan, we learned the show was far more than a 3D magazine.
A pretty girl is like a melody.
What did you need to accomplish to make this exhibit more than just beautiful pictures of beautiful people?
This was a question of full context, and it was to challenge the idea of what fashion is. Fashion is more than a dress. When you come out of this exhibition, you begin to conceive of the women who wore the clothes as being part of that very look, shaping it, contributing to it, not just reflecting it.
The show begins in 1947. It was the year that a famous photo was published, a major modeling agency was founded, and a French designer created a new style. Harold Coda showed us the picture taken by fashion photographer Irving Penn.
An iconic photograph of the 12 most photographed women in the world, which is a moment when the photographic model establishes a place and an identity in the fashion world. There is the establishment of the Eileen Ford Agency. She established the fashion model as a respectable profession. And finally, there was an extraordinary thing that was happening in Paris, which is Christian Dior was establishing his house and in 1947 launched the new look.
Yohannan and Coda enthusiastically pointed out the emblematic style of each decade. In the 40s, it was the portraits of models who make themselves nearly concave, hips thrust forward, back arched, and painted face staring into the camera. It was the signature pose of Christian Dior's new look.
The new look was a reiteration of a turn of the 20th century corseted body. And so you had women who had a constricted waist, bras that pushed up the bust, and girdles that actually suppressed the buttocks. Mm-hmm. The great model if you look at the photographs, is able to animate, despite all of this armor-like carapace that's hidden under the soft cloth, the great model is able to animate that by a modulation of her arms, the stretch of her neck, the positioning of her legs.
I don't want my hair cut. I don't want my eyebrows up or down. I want them right where they are.
A clip of the 50s classic Funny Face with Audrey Hepburn as a reluctant fashionista is projected behind some of the real couture gowns of the same era. The gowns are part of the Met's archives and have been taken out of storage for the show. There are display cases with old magazines featuring some of the best-known models of the time, some with surprising backstories, like Dorian Lee, one of the 12 beauties photographed by Irving Penn in 1947. The surprise here? Her height.
5'4".
5'4". Dorian Lee?
Good things come in small packages. Yes, this fantasy that mall models were 6 feet tall Amazons from day one, it's just not true. They ranged in size more so in the past, in fact. Dorian Lee was extraordinary, not just for exquisite beauty, but at 5'4", her proportions read exquisitely on film. She looked tall when she needed to look tall. She looked petite when she needed to look petite.
Is it a chicken, as our cultural historian, is it a chicken and the egg sort of scenario, the way the models' bodies changed from someone who was petite and super feminine like Dorian Lee to Twiggy, who boyish, no hips, small breasts, to the all-American glamazons of the 70s?
I think to a large extent body types can be reactionary to a past period. So we could look at Twiggy certainly as a denunciation and a renouncement of the ladylike, more curvy, more status-driven looks of the 1950s.
Why don't you all fail with me? Try and dig what we all say.
I think this is the loudest exhibit at the Met. We're entering the 60s.
Again, the type has changed, mm-hmm. and you're seeing a body change. The leg is completely elongated, and there's a sensuality showing up in the photography. This is new. There were no sexy photographs, particularly in the 1940s and 50s. It was more about a look but don't touch, rarefied, haughty sophistication that gives way to the youth generation and the sexual liberation of the 1960s, as seen in as much of a gaze as an alluring come-hither look in the photography.
In the 60s gallery, there's an assortment of body-revealing dresses, some short, some with suggestive cutouts. The gallery is dominated by three rotating silver metal dresses reflecting light off the walls. And in the photos, there's a nod to the changing politics of the time.
An ideal beauty essentially expands in the 1960s with the inclusion of varying forms of minority models. So we have Doña Luna in the early 1960s, the first truly celebrated great black model who puts a real focus on style, personal style, and presentation on the runway. In 1964, she gains the cover of British Vogue. In the 1970s, the fashion story was the female body.
Female sexuality was essentially unleashed during this decade. Nudity, body-hugging fabrics that left little to the imagination, with models posing in sexually aggressive ways. One picture from Vogue caused quite a controversy.
Here you see Lisa Taylor in 1975, shot by Helmut Newton, essentially inverting the male gaze. Here she is looking on to a man, a headless man, in tight-fitting clothing, with a sense of entitlement. She can. If she
wishes.
Sitting
like a guy.
Exactly.
She's sitting like
exactly.
a guy, I'll
sitting
say
like
it.
A guy. And this outraged people, strangely enough, post-feminism. There were yeah. cancellations to Vogue because of
Over
this photograph.
And the 80s was the era of these three or four women particularly who everyone knew their names. Like, I'm not sure that the average trucker in the 50s maybe knew Susie Parker. But I'm pretty sure they knew Cindy Crawford and maybe Christy Turlington.
And if you look back, interestingly,
and they definitely knew Naomi.
Supermodels were huge in the 1980s because the idea of fashion was huge. And the women that were perhaps the core of this, the Trinity, Linda, Naomi, and Christy, became the ultimate hood ornament of 1980s excess, spent money, and huge fashion statements. They were news in and of themselves.
Linda Evangelista, Naomi Campbell, Christy Turlington. It was a time of big hair, bigger paychecks. Faces that sold us everything. The pictures are more commercial, the model sometimes more important than the clothing.
And what happens, as in any great movement, if we reach the high renaissance in the late 1980s with the perfection and apotheosis of the supermodel, what's around the corner is mannerist period. It's grunge. In 1992, you're looking at a complete breakdown of the normative ideals of fashion and beauty with the grunge collections of Anna Sui and Marc Jacobs. Mm-hmm. Models like Kate Moss, Kristen McManamy, Alec Weck later. These are extraordinary, unusual, unconventional-looking women who really expand the ideal of what it meant to be beautiful.
A series of well-considered rags worn by waifish, sad-eyed beauties finishes the exhibit in a room filled with graffiti and the melancholy music of the time. The exhibit stops here in 1997, 50 years over which the ideal of beauty has transformed from the impenetrable, tightly bound, primly made-up models of the 1950s to the casual, almost sloppy elegance of grunge, each epitomizing and projecting the ideals of their decade, the model as muse.
I've been struggling a little bit with the title of the exhibit, not struggling in a bad way, but trying to figure out, for whom is the model the muse? Is it for the photographer or is it for the designer?
Well, actually it's neither, and both. Because the truth is, the model is a muse for a generation.
The Model as Muse exhibit runs through August 9th at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. To see pictures from the exhibit, you can always go to our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. Scott Simon returns next week.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The film Bruno is opening in a few weeks. It's a satire starring Sacha Baron Cohen as a flamboyantly gay fashion victim. He's the guy who 3 years ago brought you Borat, the outrageously fake journalist from Kazakhstan.
Sacha Baron Cohen is also the guy who sparked outrage and lawsuits because Borat was so offensive to so many people. And now, the studio releasing Bruno has started pre-screening it for gay activists and writers. The studio is hoping to derail charges of homophobia. NPR's Netta Ulibi says that judging from the trailer, there's a huge list of people this new movie could offend, not just gays.
What's up? I'm Bruno.
The character Bruno is Austrian. Some Austrians are reportedly less than thrilled with Bruno's assessment of the Austrian dream. Find a job, get a dungeon, and raise a family in it. So, Austrians, gay people, who else?
I'm at Milan Fashion Week.
Italians.
Yes, I'm going to wear the jumpsuit made entirely out of Velcro.
Definitely fashionistas.
You go out now.
Yeah. Euro trash.
Hi, welcome to Sears. How can I help you today?
You may find this very hard to believe, but I'm gay.
Okay.
Salesmen. Also, men.
Look at the four of us. We are so like the Sex and the City girls.
Women. Also, hunters.
I ain't either one of them. I'm Donnie.
That is such a Samantha thing to say.
Celebrities.
Angelina's got one. Madonna's got one. Now Bruno's got one.
Adoptive families.
So what's the baby's name?
I gave him like a traditional African name. OJ.
What?
Babies. Africans, Americans, African-Americans, bingo players, TV presenters, terrorists, people in the military, Hasidic Jews, fetishists. Star Sacha Baron Cohen might get away with offending 9/10 of the country. We'll see what percentage is amused. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.